Folks, we've got so much going on in this building right now, you'd think it was close to Sine Die, or at least we hope it's close to Sine Die. We will open today with a work session on House Bill 2361. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2361 was a bill that we took testimony on June 6, 2005. It would clarify that when a person has been convicted of misdemeanor driving under the influence of intoxicants for a third or subsequent time, their driver's license would be revoked. We heard testimony that judges had interpreted the statute as written to mean only a third conviction would count, not any subsequent conviction. So this just clarifies what I think everyone believes was the original legislative intent. There was no opposition to the bill.
Okay, and we do have resources in the audience if we need them. Mr. Berry's here and Ms. Pratt are here, but I think it's pretty straightforward. Senator Walker, it's House Bill 2361.
I wasn't here on the other bill, but that all made sense to me. I've reviewed it. Madam Chair, there are no amendments, so I would move House Bill 2361 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2361 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Okay, now we will open up. A carrier. Anybody interested in this one? Senator Pazansky will carry this. We will now open a work session on House Bill 2297. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. There it is. House Bill 2297 was a bill we had the work session on, public hearing on back on June 6th again. It would expand the circumstances under which public indecency is a felony by stating that if the person has an out-of-state conviction for a similar offense, then the public indecency would be elevated to a felony just as if they were had a prior conviction here in the state of Oregon. The bill had no opposition and no amendments.
Okay. Senator Walker, have you formed an opinion on this?
Sure have. That would be, Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 2297 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2297 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Whitsitt, would you like to carry that?
Sure.
Okay, now we will... We'll open a work session on House Bill 2299. Council.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2299 was before us on June 1st, 2005. There is a dash one amendment that the committee needs to consider. The original bill would allow persons who are required to register as a sex offender, it would require persons who are relieved of their registration as a sex offender to send a certified copy of the court's order to the Department of State Police. The Dash 1 amendment adds to the sex offender registration requirements that a registered sex offender must report within 10 days of the first day the person works at, carries on a vocation at, or attends an institution of higher education, and within 10 days of a change in that status of work, vocation, or attendance.
Okay, do we have anybody here on that? I think we're okay.
We do, if you need them.
Okay, we have people here if we need them. Any questions from the committee? Senator Pazansky.
We just clarification. It says institution part of education, and it says means a public or private education institution that provides a program of post-secondary education. I'm assuming that would include community colleges as well as universities.
Go ahead.
Senator Pazansky, I believe that's correct. We did. I followed up with the representatives that were here from the colleges on June 1st.
Yeah, and I'm glad you put that on the record, Senator Pazansky, since this part of this bill came to us from the community colleges. And it's certainly our intent that they be covered. Mm-hmm. Okay, we have a Dash 1 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2299.
Senator Walker has moved the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2299. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Walker, would you like to carry that?
Well, first we have to approve the bill as amended, Madam Chair.
Oh,
and then I'd be happy
to. We're going through here so quickly.
I will move House Bill 2299 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2299 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And the fact that you made the motion even after I said that means you want to carry it.
Oh, I'd love to carry it. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Now we will open a work session on House Bill 2144. Mr. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2144 would modify the conditions of probation for a person previously convicted of a sex offense as an adult or previously found within the jurisdiction of juvenile court for having committed an act that would constitute a sex offense if committed by an adult. What this essentially does is it provides the community supervision with the ability to have someone evaluated and go to treatment if they are sort of showing signs of needing that sex offender treatment. The Dash 1 amendments removed the juvenile adjudication piece from the bill. There is a new Dash 2 amendment. It would add to the bill a requirement that persons convicted of certain sex offenses have to register, and that registration then, or that person's identity, would be on the internet to make information available to the public if information is about a sex offender who was convicted of rape 1, sodomy 1, unlawful sexual penetration 1, and sex abuse 1.
Okay.
And as that is a newer amendment, I know there are people here who would be available to speak to it if we wanted to hear from them.
On the Dash 2?
Yes.
Okay, let's talk about the Dash 1 first, because I think there's some question as to whether we would need the Dash 1 exempting juveniles. I guess I'd like to have the... Who was I talking to on this? I'm on the...
Either someone from the department or the defense attorneys. We've had Kelly Skye and Colette Peters testify before.
No, I think I'm confused. I'm not confused. It's the idea of removing juvenile adjudications from the bill, so it would only count adjudications of adults offenders. So I just like to refresh for us whether this amendment is needed.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Scott Taylor, Chief of Community Corrections with the Department of Corrections. We did not feel that the Dash 1s were necessary. The intent of the bill is for us to develop a standardized way of dealing with people who've had previous sex offenses, as was noted, and been adjudicated.
Speak up, please.
And been adjudicated, and then later come back on to supervision. And our current issue is that people that come from other states and juveniles, we do not have the ability to then require them to seek an evaluation so we can determine when we have concerns that they may still have issues we need to deal with. And so the bill, I think there's always concern that we will be out looking for people that have a 30-year lapse and they had some minor crime before. With the current workload and the model we use in assessing risk, that is not the type of person we're looking for. We're looking for people who still have sex offending behavior, who are now on supervision to us for a new crime, and we know from some of the research evidence-based stuff that the folks that are engaged in another crime, our odds go up, and so that's a group we want to pay special attention to. That's one of the intents of the bill. Mr. Schreiner can talk more in depth.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Pat Schreiner with the Marion County Sheriff's Office Parole and Probation Division, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors and the Sex Offender Supervision Network. And I would echo what Mr. Taylor just said, and really, you know, remind all of you that one of the best bills that came out of this last legislative session in 2003 was Senate Bill 267 that mandated evidence-based practices in not only programming and supervision of offenders. One of the key principles of that of the evidence-based practices is good assessment. And really what we are seeing is there are offenders that come to us, and we do have good assessment tools. We do have the ability to make those assessments. We have offenders that come to us either from another state or juvenile offenders that when we start supervising them and we make those assessments, we realize that the risks they present and the treatment and supervision needs they present, it would indicate that they need to be supervised at this level in this kind of specialized programming. The workload issues are significant. We are not looking for more people to supervise as sex offenders. Again, I think I mentioned once before, Marion County has over 500 people on supervision that are sex offenders. There are 7 parole and probation officers. It's hard for them to keep up with the ones they have, so it's not looking for to expand this at all. It's just to try to respond appropriately to the community for the people who require that level.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Guy.
I'm Kelly Skye, legislative representative for the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and Chair Burdick, members of the committee. We oppose only the second part of this bill. The first part, which would include the out-of-state convictions, we don't have a position on that. It's including the juvenile adjudications that we have a problem with, and that is because, for a number of reasons, a juvenile adjudication is different. First of all, it happened when you were young. The focus of the juvenile system is to rehabilitate and to treat an individual, and they spend all of their efforts to rehabilitate and treat that juvenile while they're there. And for them to be able to treat and get past that, if a juvenile is unable to be rehabilitated or treated satisfactorily at the juvenile level, they will go to McLaren, and it's one of the places where you can get inpatient sex offender treatment is in McLaren. So even if a juvenile was not successful at the community level treating their sex offender issues, they would be forced to do it at McLaren.
Madam Chair,
Senator Brzezinski.
What I'm hearing, Ms. Skye, is that you are in favor of the Dash 1 amendments that would take out the juvenile section?
Correct. And our concern is, you know, I agree, and I sincerely believe that the people at this table have the best intentions in exercising their discretion on this, but I don't believe that that is always true of every person who has this authority, and I think that it's a pretty great authority to reach all the way back into someone's juvenile history. The person can be, you know, 40 coming in and they had a juvenile offense as, in their record and can now be required to do sex offender treatment. And if they're not successful at that, say it's on a theft conviction, you know, a felony theft, now they're required to do sex offender treatment. If they're not successful at that, or they can't afford to do it and fail at it, then they can be sent to prison on this theft that is completely unrelated to this incident that occurred when they were a juvenile. And we just think that that is it's too broad of authority, and that there's it's not clear enough that that's necessary.
All right. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Burdick, just I think what you're alluding to here is once again the in whether it's intent or the letter of the law that's important.
Correct.
And I believe it was you or someone else that testified in a previous hearing regarding the potential for someone who was charged with and convicted of statutory rape among teenagers that could end up being a sex offender in the state. Could you enlarge on that, please?
Chair Burdick, Senator Whitsitt, that is true. The sex offender, the definition of sex offense is very broad, and it does include statutory rape and other offenses that deal with sort of the age separation offenses, which can be consensual sex among people whose ages are not 18. With people who are more than 3 years older than them. And those people are required to register as sex offenders for life. Could be required to do sex offender treatment. And I know that the people here would say that they would not intend to put someone like that through treatment, but our fear is that that ability is here in this statute, and that leaving it to the discretion of people in the field, we feel that it's beyond the amount of discretion that they ought to have.
Thank you. There's one other question, Chair Burdick, and this is for anybody, either one of you gentlemen. Could you give us some sense of the number of individuals who have been convicted of sex crimes that actually develop behavior as a teenager that would indicate that they might do that?
Chair Burdick, Senator Whitsitt, and members of the committee, I don't have numbers, but what we do know from the sex offending literature that the most serious sex offenders' onset of their sex offending behavior will occur as juveniles. So they tend to start young.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? I must admit I'm a little torn on this particular one. Maybe we could have a little discussion on the merits of this amendment before we...
I think so.
Madam Chair?
Be happy to talk about it.
I'm just trying to follow the dash one. I shouldn't it say after on line 9 and not line 8? I want to insert the word or there, right?
They want to do the or on 8.
Mm-hmm. Only or?
No. You take the semicolon off at the end and you put the or.
I don't think that reads very well.
Well, you see, you're deleting this D. You're deleting D. You're going to delete D and E. So basically, you're going to have A, B, C remaining. And so they're just saying it's one of those three.
Do you want to have the discussion now, Madam Chair?
I want to have a discussion before we decide whether to move this amendment. I don't normally do that, but I'm really kind of torn on this one.
Well, let me start out, because I had raised the question initially in our first hearing, and so Max Williams and Scott Taylor and Colette Peters from the department came in to see me, and we talked, and I think I've talked with Mr. Schreiner, and after the discussion, I was comfortable with the bill because the testimony, or at least the testimony and the representation, is they're not going out searching for these kids. We certainly have, I think Max told me in a meeting in my office on May 31st, there are 3,000 sex offenders in Department of Corrections now. 3,000. That's a lot. And so they have to triage and take the ones at higher risk. So they're not specifically going out and looking for these juveniles that had some small sex offense 30 years ago. But there is a pattern with juveniles starting with sexual misbehaviors in that time period of their life. And you can trace it back, and they can very often continue to do that sort of thing. There are also only certain sex offense crimes. There are some sex offense crimes that are not waived. As a juvenile, you know, a lot of your crimes, not a lot, but a number of crimes that you commit as a juvenile are expunged from your record if you make application to the court. But there are some that are not, because they are serious enough. And I think a serious enough sex offense crime would not be expunged, and it should be used as part of your record. So I after being torn about this for a long period of time, I came around to the conclusion that I thought this was an okay bill, and I was not uncomfortable about that. So I'd love to hear what all of you have to think about it.
Others?
I'm okay with the bill with the dash twos in it specifically.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute, Senator Byers. Senator Ringo, do you have any comments on this?
Well, I'd prefer just to go with the dash ones.
How about you, Senator Pinansky?
I mean, I can go with the bill as it's written, or I can go with the dash ones. I think there's a good policy discussion for both. The one thing we haven't heard is what's happening, maybe what other models have been around the country as other states, and what they've actually have experienced. Clearly, you want to make certain, I think, on the juvenile level, that you have them in programs as quick as possible before you see, quote-unquote, the pattern set in. And the question really comes down to when you have these individuals who have had a conviction, not a conviction, but an adjudication at a when they were a minor, and 20, 30 years later, they come back in the system for something that's non-sexual in principle, or as what they're charged, then all of a sudden something's reached back that far and say, we want you to do this. What I don't see is the parameter for why that decision would be made. That's the policy part of the discussion is, if there's a nexus, I mean, if someone's acting out and let's say they're convicted of something less than a sex offense, but there's tendencies based on what that conviction or that charge was that resulted in the conviction, that there was something that is a nexus to prior conduct or current conduct that is sexual in nature, I think the PO should in fact be able to do that. But it's just, as it's written now, it seems pretty broad.
Could I respond to that? Because there was a piece in my notes here that I didn't talk about, and I think Mr. Taylor's here and he can talk about it. When you were in my office, he talked about Static 99, which is a tool for assessment in these cases. It's a nationally assessed instrument, so it's not a gut instinct of a PPO to make this decision. And maybe Mr. Taylor could share with the rest of you all what Static 99 is better than my notes can.
Chair Burdick, Senator Walker, I would be happy to do that if he's up for it. Mr. Schreiner, since he deals with it regularly, might be able to give more detail specifically on the tool.
Could you describe what this piece of instrument is?
The Static 99, there are a variety of tools that have been designed and studied nationally to predict the risk, the predatory nature of a sex offender, and uses a variety of history events and assessment that lets us sort through. And the Static 99 is a tool we've selected in Oregon. It's been nationally used and verified. And the Sex Offender Supervision Network and the Department of Correction have both adopted it as a screening tool to look at sex offenders. As we sort through, we apply this tool, a series of questions to them. And then at a certain, if you get a certain score, that triggers us that we have more concern. We want to watch much closer because the tool has been shown to predict future criminal behavior in sex offending.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds to me what you're describing is like a Q&A, just questions and answers, as compared to some type of instrument that's used to measure a human body response.
Chair Burdick, Senator Brzezinski, no, it's not like a proposnograph or something else. It is strictly when did things happen, what choices have you made, all would have been linked to future criminal behavior.
Would it be your anticipation that with in your handling of juveniles, if we continue to allow juvenile records to be used for purposes of this bill, that it would be only the extreme circumstances that you would use those? I mean, how often do you think that those would even come into play?
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, it is the more extreme cases that are going to get screened for this. I do want to dispel one myth. This is not somebody that's had up to 20, 30-year gap in criminal history. I mean, generally, what we're talking about is somebody who, there's plenty of people who are coming to the juvenile system and then desist from criminal activity and go on and become adults and become contributing members of the community in a lot of ways. This is that population that really has not desisted criminal activity, and now they're involved in criminal activity as an adult. And so we're talking generally young. The people we're talking about are usually in their early 20s that had juvenile issues, and now they're on for a criminal offense as an adult. It might be a drug offense. You know, we might be able to, we might see a connection to their substance abuse when they were juvenile to that sexual offending behavior. There's also, you know, an attempt then to determine whether they completed sex offender treatment as a juvenile. If they have, and we can get that data, that is helpful information. So it's that kind of screening that would go on, and we would use the static 99. The other, we adopted the static 99 a couple of years ago, again, after some challenges about how we were determining predatory, and the static 99 has the highest rate of validity of any sex offender assessment tool of anything in the country.
Senator Prusansky.
Let me ask the question that if you have someone that comes in as a young adult and you're taking them in intake, you give them the battery of tests, including a static 99, and it shows that there's that tendency that you're concerned with. What's to stop a PO now from requiring them to do whatever treatment or programs? Because if they're in the jurisdiction of the PO, my understanding is the court has been pretty liberal in allowing the POs to put together whatever programs they think are appropriate. And if you've got documentary evidence that it was challenged, you would be able to go in and I would assume show to the court why the assessment, maybe why the, what the assessment showed and why you're requiring them to do this. I'm just wondering if this is something that actually needs to be codified.
Chair Burdick, Senator Prusansky, members of the committee, the reason we brought this forward was exactly because we could not do that. And we had two or three cases statewide in the last year where parole and probation officers were very concerned about the risk a specific offender presented and went to the court and requested that those conditions, that this person be treated as a sex offender, and it was not... And the court denied it, and we felt that it was something that should be amended and fixed so that we have the ability to assess that.
And these cases were juveniles?
These cases were adult offenders who had a prior juvenile conviction, and so we had both the out-of-state offenders coming in and the juveniles that we ran into problems with, and that's what we, you know, spent some time talking about and said this would be a way to address that.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Madam Chair, just that's how I got over the edge that I was on was the assessment tool.
Madam Chair.
Senator Whitsitt.
I'm still a little bit concerned. I understand the intent, and I applaud the intent, but I'm not at all sure that the letter of the statute states the intent. I mean, I think it's a little too broad. Obviously, this doesn't say anything about using a static 99 test. It doesn't say anything about juvenile statutory rape. It doesn't say anything about deleting juvenile records that have been expunged.
So are you saying that you would be more comfortable with the Dash 1 amendment?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, you know what? We come back here every couple of years. Maybe we should just take a cautious approach and give the part that everyone agrees on and maybe wait a while and see how it works and come back next time maybe with some more sideboards on the juvenile fees. Okay, so we will put aside the Dash 1 amendment. We will not put aside the Dash 1 amendment. We will take a motion on the Dash 1 amendment if one is offered.
Okay, I'll offer it. Madam Chair, I can go either way, but I was quite comfortable with the bill now. But since you all like it, I will move the Dash 1 to House Bill 2144.
Okay, Senator Walker has moved the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2144. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Now we will take up the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2144. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Two. The Dash 2 amendments to 2144 takes the content of House Bill 3486, which was a bill that was introduced by a good group of us. I'm the Senator Starr and I are co-sponsors of it, along with a good share of the House members, both parties. It was introduced late in the process. The bill is now in the Information Management Technology Committee in the House. I understand the bill, the amendments have been worked on for the bill, and in order to reduce the fiscal on it, and perhaps our witnesses could talk about that because I have not been part of that discussion. But what it does is requires Internet requires Department of State Police to make information about certain sex offenders available on Internet websites. And that's what the bill does. I understand that, you know, if we were to adopt it into the bill right now, the bill would probably have to go into conference committee and get watered down somewhat or get taken some of the fences out of it to reduce the fiscal. I think I'd like to have the witnesses speak to that part of it because I was not part of those discussions.
Senator Pazansky.
Madam Chair, also I think the caution we may want to have if we are truly getting close to sunny day, which I will put on the record, I don't think we are.
But put on the record that I disagree with who we are.
Yeah, in the future, whenever that might be. I think this is going to have to go to budget just because I think the fiscal that is going to tag onto the bill. And so one of the things I hope that they, meaning the witnesses, would testify to as to whether this may hinder the other part of the bill. I mean, as the priority of the bill that's now been adopted with the dash ones, I understand it. I agree. I mean, this is one of the areas that I've had a lot of constituents, both rural and urban, that are concerned that there's not easy access to this information. And I think what Senator Byer is trying to do, narrow it to what I understood would be probably the predatory sex offenders as compared to anyone that might be just a sex crime, that would hopefully bring it down. It would be the ones I would be most, I am most concerned with in communities. But I think we just need to hear that, put that on the record as to what impact it may have as to the bill actually making it through the process.
Madam Chair,
Senator Walker,
it was my understanding the federal government just started a sex offender internet program that was countrywide, went all across the United States. Am I incorrect in that? And if they have, then why are we spending our money doing one?
Would that be just limited to federal offenses? As
well, I don't know. Maybe somebody here is going to be able to talk about it, but I had read that.
Madam Chair, if you look at Section 3 of the amendment, it does say that adding links to websites required by this connect to other sex offender websites run by Oregon counties or by the federal government.
Okay.
So it would allow them to link to, if they're the federal one, they can link to that.
I'd like to make a suggestion here. If there's interest in the committee on pursuing this, I would like to suggest that we tomorrow are going to be, we still have time to post for tomorrow. We have other bills in the committee that we are not going to move that have relating clauses on them. They probably, most of them are Senate bills, but I think I would be concerned of weighing this particular bill down and facing a potential budget committee referral on this committee. On this particular bill, but if there's interest in the committee, then I'd be happy to work with counsel or Mr. Dempsey has just stepped in because we're going to be taking a recess here in a couple minutes just to finalize our last day tomorrow. And so let's have a little discussion around that and see if there is interest in pursuing that.
Well, Madam Chair, obviously I'm interested in pursuing that amendment here. So.
But Madam Chair, from my perspective, I am new to this issue. I would need to hear a lot of the issue.
Yeah. I have no problem with this moving as something that's uniformity for the state. The concern is, I know that some counties have, on their own initiative, have actually implemented some type of web-based identification or locators to give that information out. Where other counties are probably based on their priority of resources just have not done that or have the ability to. And I don't want to see, I guess, what would be an unfunded mandate to the counties forcing them to do it. It seems to me that there should be some type of, let's call it more of a universal system at the state level to provide whatever is going to be the consistency and continuity of this type of a program with whatever sideboards and
limitations of how it's going to be used, how long the stuff stays into the system. Because at some point, I would think that under our current system of justice, you have to let it go if there's not continued activity and allow people to move in and do, you know, and be productive again without being stigmatized for decades. But at the same time, if they're acting out or if they're under a current supervision, they need to, I think those are legitimate concerns, and people should have access to that information, and I just would hope that we would do something that would be uniformity for the state and not seeing some counties not being able to do it and others do it.
Thank you. Senator Walker, did you have an opinion on this?
No. I agree. I have a lot of constituents who call and wonder why we don't have them in all counties, and I think it's a valid amendment that Senator Byers bringing forward. The issue is, does this kill the bill because it goes down to budget? How does it come out? And we're sort of at the end of the session.
Speak
to that.
Yeah,
because they may be able to tell us that. I don't know their information either. I'd like to hear that.
Is there a specific question? I mean, I have a lot of things to say, but I'm not sure where you want to start.
Why don't you just address the amendment, since if you'd be willing to do that.
We particularly have some problems with this amendment. We spent significant time. It started with Representative Olson on the House side, and then spent probably 3 hours over the course of 2 days with Representative Crummell and Don Phillips on this bill. One piece of history that came up, one of the things I did get challenged on the House side by Representative Olson about the lack of consistency statewide on community notification, particularly counties not utilizing website notification for high-risk predatory sex offenders. Excuse me. We acknowledged that, and then we had a Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors meeting in mid-May, and at that meeting we got buy-off from all the counties statewide to commit to developing a website to post the highest risk, most dangerous sex offenders in their community that they determined by the risk tool, Static 99, and then staffing to determine what level of notification is required. And that was really the way we crafted the work we did with Representative Crummell. We brought that back, and we let Representative Crummell know that if we adopt this with these particular crimes, we will greatly increase notification. That information will go out there. But we don't see the net benefit, because many of these offenders are not the highest risk, most predatory, dangerous sex offenders. And then you get into a situation where you notify on everybody and you don't really help the community understand where the risk is. So what the agreement was, that each of these counties would have their highest risk predatory sex offenders, that community corrections ways and they look at what is needed in notification. Does this person need a targeted, more narrow notification? Do they need the widespread notification?
Okay, I think I'm going to stop you there. I think this is a more lengthy discussion than we're prepared to have around this bill, Senator Byer. But what I will do is work with Mr. Dempsey and Mr. O'Leary to make sure that there is a bill that finds its way to the Rules Committee where you can use it as a vehicle to continue the discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, we approved the dash one, so I will move House Bill 2144 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2144 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. I will carry this bill. We will be in recess for 15 minutes. My apologies. We have some business that has to be taken care of right now for tomorrow's meeting. So we will be in recess until 2:30? Until 2:30. Thank you. Committee will reconvene out of recess. We will now open a work session on 2312. And here's how this work session is going to work. We're going to have Mr. Berry come up, and he has 2 minutes to say whatever he wants, and Ms. Meyer has 2 minutes, and then we're going to rock and roll. And y'all know what I'm talking about. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Keeping time.
Yes. Keeping time. Members of the committee, House Bill 2312 would extend the time by which a motion requesting performance of DNA testing can be filed. There are -A3 amendments before the committee. The -A3 amendments would allow, would expand the situations under which a person can file this affidavit of innocence to include pleas of guilty and no contest. The original law only allowed for persons who were convicted at trial.
Okay, Mr. Berry, would you comment, please, on the -A3 amendments?
Chair Burdick and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. As I testified the other day when this matter came up, it's been our position.
Excuse me, state who you are.
I'm sorry, I'm Brad Berry. Yeah, I'm the county district attorney.
I'm trying to be quick.
My 2 minutes is running.
2 minutes starts now. Yes.
I'm also here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. As the committee is well aware, the original DNA post-conviction relief bill passed and allowed for a sunset coming up and provided for the opportunity of those who have been convicted of crimes where in fact they can set forth in affidavit form that DNA evidence would prove their innocence, so it's not just might be helpful, could bring those matters via post-conviction relief and without time limits. We didn't oppose that bill. I don't think it's been particularly well used, but it was limited to those who had gone to trial. And in fact, I think the original intent of the bill was to recognize situations where before DNA was regularly utilized.
Senator. Okay, we need to stop the conversation. Thank you. I apologize. We're running out of members. We've had a hearing. I was going to give this as a courtesy. And I don't have time. We have,
okay.
And I do apologize.
No problems. Thank
you, Chair. I misunderstood Senator Ringo. I thought it was 2:45, but it's actually now.
Mine's 2:45.
So I apologize, Mr. Berry. Senator Walker, we have a -A3 amendment in front of us.
Okay, Madam Chair, I move the -A3 to House Bill 2312.
Senator Walker moves the -A3 amendment to House Bill 2312. Is there any discussion? Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm opposed to this motion. I think the bill as presented to us is a good bill. This bill opens the door for people who pleaded guilty. I don't think that's appropriate.
Appreciate that. Other discussion? I don't normally opine before a vote, but I do believe that with ballot measure 11 in effect in this state, that we have a number of circumstances where people feel very pressured to plead guilty, and I think it's fair to assume that some percentage, however small, of that population might in fact be innocent. There were examples provided during the public hearing of people who were later proved innocent, who did indeed plead guilty, and I believe this is a very good policy. It's very narrowly written. It wouldn't be a surprise to me if very, very few people use it. But I think in the interest of fairness and justice, I think this is a positive change, this bill. So I apologize for the speech.
I love the speech, Madam Chair, because I agree with everything you say. I don't see a darn thing wrong with trying to protect innocent people who may have copped a guilty plea because of whatever reason. They maybe don't have the money to have proper defense or whatever the reason. We should never give anyone the opportunity to prove their innocence if they are indeed innocent.
Thank you. Senator Whitfield.
Madam Chair, I will support this amendment. I once again am uncomfortable with the alacrity with which these things are moving through. I did have time to read this amendment, but we haven't obviously had time to listen to testimony on the amendment. I think that's a mistake.
We've had this amendment for a while, I believe, Senator. It's dated May 12th. Hmm. So, okay. Why don't you call the roll on the -A3 amendment?
Yeah,
Senator Beyer?
No.
Senator Brzezinski?
Aye.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Shaw excused. Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Five ayes, one name, one excuse.
Senator Walker?
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2312 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2312 as amended to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Senator Beyer objects. So ordered. I will carry this bill. Thank you, Senator Ringo. Thank you, committee. Okay, what do we do? I lost my marked up copy here.
And we have two left.
2142.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Barr.
I should have asked, do you have a fiscal on that amendment yet?
There was no fiscal.
We heard
that there might be, but I had people check into it, and there's no fiscal this time. Unless you know otherwise.
Madam Chair, this morning, one of the proponents of the amendments asked me if I had heard anything about a memo from the state police regarding a fiscal impact. I had not. There is no memo that I'm aware of, although I know that OSP has said that this could add some cost to it. But fiscal, because the Dash A3s just were adopted today, now fiscal will send out the amendment to people like OSP, and then if there is a substantial fiscal, we'll certainly hear about it.
Okay, thank you. Now we will open a work session on House Bill 2142. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2142 was on for public hearing yesterday. This is the bill that would specify and clarify under which situations Department of Corrections employees may and may not use deadly physical force. There is a Dash A2 amendment that adds some additional language regarding levels of force, or I think some people call it continuum of force, that we discussed, the committee discussed briefly yesterday, and it was decided that everyone needed a night to contemplate. So here we are.
Okay, thank you. Committee, having contemplated this, I really like the intent of the Dash A2 amendment, but I was persuaded by the Department of Corrections folks that this gradation of force is already being trained for and is already inherent in their rules. So I would prefer to send the bill to the floor as it is without the amendment, but would welcome discussion if others disagree.
I could have gone either way, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I'm going to vote for it either way, but the thing that we talked about yesterday, I talked to the counsel for DOJ during our break, actually, and there is one thing that I will agree that there is a difference of standard for people who have been convicted as to falling under Eighth Amendment protections as compared to Fourth Amendment as to someone that might be on the outside. But clearly, I want it on the record that no matter what action is taken inside the walls or outside the walls, if it's a use of force issue, they're going to have the experts coming in and testifying as to how these people are trained and how they actually utilize that force. Clearly, this amendment would have provided the same level of coming in under the training and applying whatever level of force that was reasonably necessary under the circumstances at that point in time, and then they would be gauged. If they had compliance, they would be required to lessen the force. If they had did not have compliance, they could increase the level of force. Now, this clearly is dealing in the area of use of deadly force when you're talking about the prison situation of someone escaping. And so that puts in another arena of what is the protocol as to these no-pass zones or areas where these individuals have been, meaning the inmates know that if they enter these areas, they have basically put themselves in jeopardy because it means that they're on the wall or close to the wall for escape. And one of the other issues that was discussed in my conversation with DOJ was that what the amendment actually reflects is what is the standard at common law level. So in common law, this is what they are held to. And so that's why he felt that it would be would have been reasonable to include it, if it was going to be included, with the phrase, when circumstances reasonably allow. And that's pretty much the standard that he told me was taken from and what is included in the common law. But either way.
I appreciate that, Senator Pradanski. Any other discussion? Senator Walker, we could use a motion on
yes.
House Bill 2142.
Without amendments, Madam Chair, I'll move House Bill 2142 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2142 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Pradanski, if you would carry that, please.
Well, and Madam Chair, before we go off this bill, I did tell counsel this afternoon when we got together that I apologize if my comments yesterday were a little heated, but my position is that anyone that's in these areas are going to be potentially challenged based on the use of force that's used, mm-hmm. and the standard is going to will dictate that they're going to be judged based on their training, which does in fact have the continual course at DPSST and any other academy training they have.
Thank you. Okay, final bill on our agenda today is House Bill 2224. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2224A would require the appellate court, after reversing some but not all counts on appeal, to remand the case to the trial court for resentencing on the remaining counts. There is a -A2 amendment before the committee. It changes the statute into which the concept is included, so it replaces the bill by changing which statute is being amended. And the practical effect of changing the statute is that it would only affect felony cases.
Okay.
Where does that come, this -2 amendment, come from?
That comes from the Attorney General, Department of Justice. They requested that change.
Okay, I don't know. Okay. Mr. Neely, maybe you and your sidekick can come up and tell us a little more about the -2. Oh, Mr. Fessner is here. We get a. You brought in the big brass here. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Burdick, attorney.
Thank you. I'm Jonathan Fessner from the Department of Justice. The only reason for the -A2 amendment is that the original bill, as it originally was drafted, amended ORS 138-240, I believe it was, which applies to all appeals. And that would include appeals that dealt entirely with misdemeanor crimes. And the whole focus of this bill really is to deal with sentencing guidelines, felony crimes, which are all sentenced under a comprehensive scheme such that if you remove one piece of that interlocking set of sentences on appeal, the whole scheme kind of unravels. And that was why we wanted to ensure that those cases go back for global resentencing. The same is not true for misdemeanors, and that's the reason for the change.
Okay, I think your word has probably reached you. I have a lot of concern about this because I could see a situation where someone had some combination of concurrent and consecutive sentences and one of them gets thrown out, and so I think the intent, if a sentence is thrown out, I think the intent is that a person doesn't serve the time for that sentence, and yet under this it would seem that it could go back and they could rejigger the sentences to be just as long as they were before the sentence was thrown out. Can you address that?
Chair Burdick, your description, I think, is accurate enough insofar as it's focusing on one of multiple sentences. The problem is, though, that what we have here, when you have a case, that is, all of the counts, let's say, that were pleaded in one indictment, tried in one trial, and sentenced by one judge at one time, is you have one overall total sentence. And there are a lot of very complex sentencing guidelines rules that govern how those sentences are to be imposed. Without getting into them here, let me just give you one example that actually comes from a case in the Court of Appeals. you have a defendant who is sentenced on the first count and gets whatever sentence the defendant gets. Then when it comes to the second count, if that first count was not part of the same criminal episode as the second count, that conviction is added in to the person's criminal history score. And so when sentenced on the second count, they're now in a higher criminal history category. Mm-hmm. And so on. Say you have four counts. By the time you get to count number four, this person's criminal history score has bumped up each time. If the person appeals, and on appeal, the Court of Appeal says, you know, you're right, the conviction on the first count is reversed, then what you end up with is a defendant who has a more onerous sentence on the remaining counts and can't do anything about it unless all those counts are sent back to the trial judge, at which point the trial judge has discretion as to what to do. And to perhaps partially address your concerns, it is by no means automatic that a judge would say, well, I thought that for this bundle of crimes that you did, X was the appropriate overall sentence, and now that there are only three crimes instead of four, I'm going to adjust all the other sentences to get back to the original. The judge might very well say, you know, I sentenced you to what I thought was appropriate for four crimes. Now the court has told us you really only committed three. I'm going to lower your sentence. So it works both ways. And what it really is designed to do, I think, is to permit judges to impose appropriate overall sentences, whatever they may be, once they understand that a certain sentence is no longer in the mix. And however the judge thinks is fair to do it, that's what the judge should have the opportunity to do.
Madam Chair.
Senator Barr.
Thank you. Under the current situation we have with Blakeney, the judge can't go back and upwardly depart off of the Criminal Justice Commission, you know, whatever line that person's in. Even so, I guess this is a question, I guess. So wouldn't that prevent the judge from doing that unless they want to go back and retry the case and give the reasons for an upward departure? So in effect, if there are three counts and you got 6 months for the first one, a year for the second one, and 2 years for the third one, or vice versa, or whatever, if throughout the middle one, the judge can't go back and say, well, I want to tack that year on to these other two, unless that's in that sentencing guideline scheme. They can't do that, can they?
Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, I think you're correct in this. When a case is sent back for resentencing, it starts all over. And the court will be bound by whatever the law requires in terms of imposing sentences. And we've had this issue come up repeatedly since Blakely has come out. And in fact, we have some cases currently, a couple of mandamus cases in the Supreme Court, that have to do with how do you handle a case on remand when Blakely was decided during the pendency of the appeal. I think the answer to it from our perspective is that if the court imposed an upward departure sentence the first time, let's say, and it comes back for resentencing, the court can again impose an upward departure sentence provided that the court complies with the constitutional requirements of the Blakely decision. And that would mean impaneling a jury or having the defendant waive jury and going from there. I realize, and I think in all fairness I have to say that there is a it certainly is true that it's not 100% guaranteed as to how all this will play out in the courts over the next many years as these issues get litigated. Our best estimate now is there isn't a problem with remanding a case for resentencing and impaneling a jury if the defendant wants one and having a Blakely resentencing trial.
Thank you. I guess my question is, what happens if we don't pass this?
Well, to be as good a crystal ball gazer as I can, I think probably not much. I mean, to be candid with you, I don't view this as attempting to make a big change in the law, but really to clarify and cement in place what the Court of Appeals, at least, is currently doing with these cases. There's been some discussion. I think I referred to it in some of my written testimony and in the memorandum that I think you've subsequently received. About a case called State versus Rodvelt. And in the Rodvelt case, that's what the court did. The court said, we're sending all the cases back for all the counts back for resentencing. The point about Rodvelt is, yes, that's what the court is doing now. There was a big, energetic dissent by Presiding Judge Edmonds in that case, and the Supreme Court, to my knowledge, has never directly answered that question. So it's a little bit up in the air. So I suppose, Senator, to answer your question, or Chair Burdick, to answer your question, probably not a great deal is going to change if you don't pass this. We think it would clarify the law and provide better guidance for the courts so we know what the rules are going to be.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you. Committee, this is still something I'm struggling with, and Senator Brzezinski had a couple questions he wanted to ask, and I think Senator Ringo was also interested in this, so I am going to roll this over to tomorrow's meeting, and I want to flag the committee that tomorrow could be quite a marathon, so we all need to get a lot of sleep tonight, and tomorrow will be the last Judiciary Committee meeting, aside from the meth work session that we will hold sometime in the next 2 weeks. So thank you very much, Mr. Fussner. If you wouldn't mind coming back tomorrow to answer the other questions, that'd be great.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 2224, and we will adjourn Senate Judiciary. I didn't forget your name, did I?
Nope. You did everything.